Many people were introduced to the music of Scott Joplin through the movie The Sting, but in his day, Joplin was a successful songwriter who aspired to write more serious works. The Tin Pan Alley Rag, Mark Saltzman's Play with Music, imagines a meeting between Joplin and Irving Berlin at a time when Joplin was trying to find a producer, or at least a publisher, for his opera Treemonisha. It's now being performed at the Roundabout's Laura Pels Theater on 46th Street off 6th Avenue, and joining me now to talk about it are Michael Boatman, who plays Scott Joplin.
Hello.
And musical director Michael Patrick Walker. Welcome to our show, and I hope this doesn't get too confusing because you're both named Michael, and so is the actor who plays Irving Berlin, Michael Theriault.
And there is one more Michael in the production. Michael McCormick, who plays Irving Berlin's assistant, Teddy Snyder. So
what happened during rehearsals when somebody said Michael?
I think they broke us down to Michaels 1 through 4, or Michael B, Michael W, Michael, you know. And just for our purposes now, we just decided that Michael Patrick Walker, our musical director, shall be Michael Patrick.
It's very formal, but yes, it will suffice.
And you'll be Michael.
And I'll be Michael. Now, it gets confusing when you realize my middle name is also Patrick, so.
Did you know much about Scott Joplin before you took this role?
You know, like I think many Americans, I knew about The Sting from the movie, and we had sort of an old, you know, out-of-tune piano in my house as a kid growing up in Chicago, and I do remember sitting there trying to play it on you know, various annoying occasions. And so it is very funny now to actually be playing this part and playing the part, if you will, fake playing, thanks to the, you know, auspices of Michael Patrick Walker.
Michael Patrick, didn't Joplin live in New York for a time?
It's
he
true.
Died here, didn't he?
He did. I believe he's actually buried in Queens, if I'm remembering
that
this
I
correctly.
Didn't know.
But yeah, he. Thus, the premise of the play is at least theoretically possible, because he and Berlin would have been in New York in a very small industry at the time.
And I understand his publisher was in the same building.
That's apparently true. Yes, that.
So they would have met on the stairs, if nothing else.
Very possibly, they may have passed each other. They may have actually said hello. Hard to say.
Yeah. Do you think that they would have been aware of each other because they were both called the King of Ragtime? At the time.
I mean, I would have to think that even if they never met, I'm sure that they at least would be aware of one another. And Berlin at that time was, while not the Irving Berlin we eventually came to know, certainly still very well known. And Joplin, of course, quite well known at that point.
Well, he'd already written Alexander's Ragtime Band.
Absolutely.
At the time of this play, 1915, because he'd written Alexander's Ragtime Band in 1911.
Yeah.
And that was really the big breakthrough for him.
Right.
But
sure.
It's not a rag.
It's not, I guess, technically considered
no.
a rag, is it? It's sort of rag-infused pop music of the day, right?
In fact, we have a clip
in
which Michael, as Scott Joplin, explains the concept of syncopation to a German symphonic conductor. Let's listen to it.
White, European, serious, see? One, two, three, four, strong, weak, strong, weak. Now I'll add the right hand, sticking to the same style. Strong, weak, strong, weak. Just an on-the-beat, lockstep march. But if I play the left hand like I've been doing it, and the right hand gets a little out of step, gets a little rebellious, and starts putting the stress on the wrong beats, we fly to a raggy new world.
Because now the right hand has syncopation. An African rhythm.
Right. That's the black part.
And that was you, Michael, with James Judy.
Yes, the wonderful James Judy, who plays Ernst, the symphonic conductor that Joplin met in real life, and that is actually sort of recounted in the play.
And who pronounces it syncopation.
Syncopation, yeah. What I love about that scene, is, and even from the very first time I read it, is that it is such, and this is due to the skills, obviously, of Mark Saltzman, the playwright, but it's such a beautiful description of all the pop music that sort of came to follow, you know, the mixture of the rhythms, you know, the African, the European, and how, and I just think that's brilliant.
Because syncopation really is the basis of jazz, and what makes jazz swing,
mm-hmm.
and then pretty much all the popular music that followed in America.
Yeah.
Although ragtime only had a limited run.
Mm. Right, but it was sort of the pop music of its day, right? I mean,
yeah.
It was, you know.
And as you say, sort of the foundation of so many other things that came after. What I enjoy very much about that, too, is it's rather an esoteric concept to someone who's perhaps not musically inclined, syncopation, but it's such an important concept to ragtime into the play.
Well, we're starting to get more and more plays that are explaining these complicated things. We had 33 variations explaining how Beethoven wound up writing a series of variations at the end of his life. Now we have an explanation of syncopation. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm going to start sending little notes to playwrights and say, well, you know, I'm a bit confused about fugues.
There you go.
The action of this play takes place in a single night with lots of flashbacks when Scott Joplin comes to Irving Berlin's sheet music company hoping to find a publisher for his opera Treemonisha. And this is right after a real event, isn't it? 1915, where Scott Joplin had presented done a presentation before some bankers some backers, potential bankers in Harlem?
Absolutely. I mean, for the purposes of the play, the timeline is finessed a little bit. It happened actually a little bit earlier than that in actuality. But yes, he had put quite a bit of his own money into a presentation, sort of what we perhaps today would consider a staged reading, as it were, but, you know, without orchestrations.
You have to wonder why, considering the positive message of this opera, which won a Pulitzer Prize many years later, that it was so rejected at the time.
It's interesting. I think about that all the time when you realize, as you know, some of the biographies I've read about Joplin relate, that he essentially really broke himself. He broke his will. I mean, he died shortly after. His play Treemonisha was roundly panned by all of these backers in Harlem. And these were, you know, African-American businessmen at the time. And for the reasons that we cite in the play, they didn't think it was progressive enough. They wanted a more sort of showy, flashy, ragtime experience. And he was...
Well, they wanted a hit play.
And they wanted a hit, exactly. And it is that sort of strange, stereotypical musician character who's always saying, you know, my stuff, it's not quite, you know, no one's ready for it yet. The people aren't ready for it yet. But in about 10, 20, 30 years, yeah, they will be. And in his case, it was 50 years or something.
And part of the play involves him meeting Irving Berlin, who understands perfectly the idea of creating a good hook, of writing a classic 32-bar pop song, and always thinking about how the public is going to like it. In the case of Irving Berlin, maybe the greatest that ever was.
Yeah.
And this is early in his career, but it's likely that he would have argued the kind of arguments we get in the play.
Sure. I think there's a sort of a nascent realization in the play on Joplin's part when we do the scene at the end where he, with American Symphony, the sort of made-up Berlin thing that Michael Walker did for us in the show. I think there's a sort of realization on Joplin's part that he has, while not necessarily been outstripped by Berlin, he's certainly been sort of outmatched, but in a beautiful way, as it's written, that he sees this is sort of the music of the future.
Michael Patrick, was Berlin involved as much in music publishing as in writing songs?
Absolutely. There was Berlin and Snyder. There was, I always get a consonant wrong, but I don't know if it was Waterson or Waterston. I always get there was actually a third gentleman in real life, and they did self-publish and published a lot of these sorts of things.
Because in those days it was sheet music sales where you made your money, not records came later.
Well, that was really the only thing. I mean, I often talk about in developing the play, there's no definitive recording you can go to. All you have is the sheet music, and at the time, if you couldn't quite sing the high note and you were a singer somewhere, you just rewrote it. So it's very difficult to find, other than going to the original music, what they may have intended.
But the music had to not only be catchy, it also had to be easy enough for amateur pianists to be able to play.
Absolutely. I mean, it's funny you say that Berlin probably would have made these arguments that he makes in the play, and it's very likely. In fact, his descendants, his daughters and so forth, actually requested that he be referred to as a songwriter and not a composer, which, you know, sounds to us today like, oh, well, that's a downplaying him, but that's what he considered himself.
But it's also interesting that this is a time when the country is deeply segregated, and yet musical crossover is happening all the time. In fact, one of the early hit versions of Alexander Ragtime Band is by Bessie Smith, the great blues singer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is. It's sort of a testament to the power of music, which I think, particularly popular music, obviously, to bridge those gaps, that, you know, to have certain music performed was, you know, depending on where you were in the country, it could be, you know, illegal. I mean, the idea that people once thought Elvis Presley's music was somehow subversive and somehow...
It isn't?
It certainly was then.
And I think
he wiggled his hips.
Yes, it was right. Awful. And music also, I think, often does that. Because if you like the music, people can somehow get past perhaps who's singing it or what it... And I think that's... certainly at this time, it was a much bigger deal in the time of the play. But I think it's always true that if you like the song... That's really all that matters.
Now, the play opens with a bunch of different songwriters coming in to plug their songs, hoping that they'll be published. Did you make them all up?
I didn't, and I say this with the greatest of love. Mark Saltzman, the playwright, and Brad Ellis, who helped him write these, they wrote some intentionally...
Inane.
Less than stellar song, shall we say, intentionally so that they could be rejected. But yes, there are some new pieces that Mark and Brad wrote for the show.
Well, I mean, with great titles like The Turkey Trot. And,
oh, yes, they're lovely, lovely pieces of work. They'll be on the cast album, I'm sure.
Right.
My guests are Michael Patrick Walker, musical director of the new play, The Tin Pan Alley Rag, and Michael Boatman, who plays Scott Joplin. Scott Joplin. It's about Scott Joplin and Irving Berlin meeting, but it has a lot of other cast members as well. And it is currently at the Laura Pels on West 46th Street off of 6th Avenue. It's called Off-Broadway, but it's closer to Broadway than some Broadway theaters, which is kind of weird, isn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. It's strange to think that we're, you know, doing an Off-Broadway show. I don't quite get it because I can throw a stone and hit Broadway.
Now, both of these guys were called the king of ragtime, but it's only fair to say that Scott Joplin was the king of ragtime. This is almost like when we have the Paul Whiteman being called the king of jazz at a time when Louis Armstrong is pretty much the most dominant figure in the field.
Yeah. I mean, it's an old story, isn't it? I mean, where you know, you have a Berlin who sort of takes this stuff and makes it, quote-unquote, mainstream, which really just means acceptable to a wider number of people, that Joplin wasn't able to reach simply by virtue of the fact that he was black.
But Scott Joplin also strikes me as being similar to somebody like George Gershwin later, because even though he has these commercial hits, Maple Leaf Rag was a monster bestseller, wasn't it?
Yeah. They talk about it in the play, how it changed his life and allowed him to become, you know, somewhat independent.
The Entertainer, also maybe not as big a hit, although later, if he had lived, he would have made a fortune from The Sting. And yet he wants to do something serious. He wants to do his version. Later we get Gershwin with Porgy and Bess and Rhapsody in Blue.
Yeah, it's amazing, this idea that this man who sort of, you know, finished his life with a vision that we certainly would respect today. I mean, and have it. Won a Pulitzer Prize in 75, I guess. But at the time, it was sort of too progressive, I guess.
Well, but one of the other things that comes out here is that Joplin was classically trained to some degree, while Irving Berlin couldn't read music. Mm-hmm. In fact, he needed somebody to actually write down the notes because he played everything in C major. He just adjusted his piano so that he could compose in other keys.
Yeah, I mean, F sharp actually was his key. He played
on
the black keys for what I guess it was easier to put his hands. And then he had the first piano he used to call the Buick because it had a large wheel that would adjust so that he could play in whatever key he wanted. But it must have made mid-song key changes rather difficult. But other than that,
you couldn't modulate.
Not without a brief break, just to crank the wheel.
One of the other things that the play points out is that both of them had tragic first marriages, and that is real history.
I believe so, yeah. I think that there, you know, though I've heard a couple of stories now, I'm not quite sure what the real facts are now, but I've heard that somehow Freddie is the character of Scott Joplin's first wife in the play, that she might have been, you know, borrowed from another wife or something. I haven't heard.
Yeah, in reality, Freddie Alexander was his second wife in history, but she did, the facts of her death and Dorothy Goetz's death, Berlin's first wife, are true.
Yeah.
That they both died very shortly after each man was married.
Yeah, 10 weeks in the case of Scott Joplin. Mm-hmm.
The stage is set with two pianos. Their backs facing the audience, and while the actors look like they're playing, the music is actually being played off stage?
Yes. The Laura Pels Theater, while a lovely space, doesn't have a pit. And even if it did, for this particular illusion to work as well as it does, we would have to be elsewhere.
How difficult was that to synchronize? Because you do have to, it does have to look like, Michael, you are actually playing the piano and you do things and you make faces and you move your arms in the right way so that it looks like you're actually playing it. But I'd imagine the pianist has to be totally aware of what you're doing at that moment.
Yeah, it's a pretty remarkable system they've devised to be able to keep us in touch with each other. Their cameras are positioned all around the theater and all around the pianos so that they can see where our hands are. And we obviously, as I said to someone, I told my mother a few weeks ago, I said I've had weeks now of fake piano playing classes. And you know, sitting with Michael and with Brian, our other pianist, and trying to, and once you learn the song and you know where your hands are supposed to be, then you can feel a little bit freer too.
I do admire the leap of faith though that the actors take every night when they just put their hands on the keys and heaven help them if I'm nodding off at the stick.
But. Right, exactly.
One of the big differences between these two composers is that Scott Joplin had pretty much written all of the most famous songs, whereas for Irving Berlin, there were only one or two, and most of the really famous ones were to follow in a very, very long life. He probably is the most remarkable songwriter ever because he kept on changing, adjusting as musical tastes adjusted, so that we wind up with Call Me Madam and all sorts of things later that have very little in common with the early things he wrote, or the things he wrote for Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers.
It's up to, I mean, just the length of time. I mean, I think any person would grow, I mean, hopefully grows as an artist over that time, but the fact that, you know, we're literally, he's about 28 at the time of the play, and, you know, died at 101.
And you have to give a sense of all that's to come without suddenly becoming anachronistic.
Sure, sure.
In the case of Treemonisha, it finally was produced, and as I said, in the 70s, and won a Pulitzer Prize.
Mm-hmm,
and you have staged portions of it to give us a real sense of it.
Right, sort of representational. We don't do, actually, we do one full song when we're indicating the backers' audition when that's dramatized in the play, and then the rest of it, we do a large chunk of the finale to sort of show that.
Is it produced much these days?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't believe so. I don't feel like it's the kind of thing that, you know, even to this day, people don't quite understand it.
Right. I don't hear about very many productions these days. But strangely enough, since I've been involved with this play, I have heard from people who repeatedly have come up and said, I saw it back in 1975 at the Kennedy Center, or I saw it on Broadway. You know, back in whenever, or the Houston Civic Opera, or
Houston
something,
Grand did, Opera,
Houston,
did it.
Houston Grand Opera, and so I'll run into people who see and remember it and have it. You know, this sort of, oh, I said, do you think it'll ever come back to, you know, we'll come to Broadway? Someone just asked me this at the show the other night, so I'd actually would love to see it.
Well, it is this odd fusion of serious operatic music with ragtime rhythms.
Yeah,
people singing in opera styles with syncopation behind them.
Right, but it's also, it's amazing. As I play, as I pretend to play on stage, one of the numbers in I want to See My Child, that song is so replete with so many, I mean, gospel music of the time sort of is infused, and it always chokes me up, along with the other, Bethina, that's the song that's sort of a testament to his wife that I play at one point, is also just an amazing song. It's an amazing mix of, it sounds like some of the old gospel songs I remember going to when I was a kid in church back in Chicago, as well as, you know, classical, you know, elements and ragtime, and it's amazing.
It really is beautiful. A lot of, I mean, most of the stuff that he wrote.
We have information about show times and everything else on our show page at WNYC.org. The play, The Tin Pan Alley Rag, is at the Laura Pels Theater. That's at 111 West 46th Street, and it runs until September 6th, at which time you go off and do something else?
At which time I have a television gig lined up at this point, or I'm waiting to hear about that. So.
And my great thanks to Michael Boatman and to Michael Patrick Walker for being on our show today. Let's go out with a little Irving Berlin.
And with a panel, I love to meddle, not only music from Broadway. I'm so delighted when I'm invited to hear a long-haired genius play.
I gave him that line.
Like hell! So you can keep your fiddle, and your bow can be a P-I-A-N-O-O-O. I love to stop right beside an upright or a higher toned.